the way, following the way, following your way. And apparently the word weird is another word, it's a synonym, an old English word for way. A weird is a road or a path. So you have to follow your weird. Because your weird is different than everybody else's weird. And your mind responds uniquely. We're all working on universal principles, but there is a certain unique weirdness to each person's mind. You have to find out what its tastes are. You don't just command that it, you know, eat your Brussels sprouts. You know, that doesn't make you like Brussels sprouts. So you have to investigate the skillful means and employ them at the right time. Not to just ride roughshod, take one technique and try to make it do for everything. And if it's not very skillful or responsive to your unique individual personality. So I'll leave that for your reflection today. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. I almost hate to mention it, but it is getting time, close to the time to go back to the world. Everybody will be facing that prospect with different attitudes. Some people really, people, you know, in the interviews and so forth, express various attitudes. Some people, absolute dread of going back to it. Just want to stay in the retreat, just getting into it, just starting to settle down. Other people are expressing relief, you know, finally, just can't wait to get back to supper, you know. Different things, different attitudes. So there is no one thing that you can say to everybody about leaving a retreat or anything like that. Some people have a very, you know, their practice is pretty good, their life is fairly simple, and they're going back to just looking forward to bringing back some new sort of clarity about their practice or a new revelation that they had in the retreat to apply in their life. And others are wondering how they're going to manage to sustain any kind of structure in their life, because there's so many burdens, so much busyness, so much resistance in their family or their social structure to even having a moment of quiet, you know, to be able to withdraw for a while, have a half an hour for solitude. But one way or the other, it certainly behooves us to take some time, some formal time for meditation on a regular basis. The Buddha was very big on regularity. Touching base often, he felt was more important than just once in a while having a good sort of a retreat. It's kind of a regular basis. But he also was big on retreats every now and then. He himself, even after he attained full Buddhahood, would go off on solitary retreats. He would tell his attendant, Ananda, also a monk, for the next period of time, up to 3 months, I don't want to see anybody. I don't want to talk to anybody. Just the person who brings the one meal a day, just another monk would bring a meal to him, and that would be it. And he wouldn't be talking to anybody, so forth. He was drawn into solitude, and he would tell Ananda, his attendant, if anybody asks what I'm doing, what do I do while I'm in these retreats? What does a Buddha do? You know, what does he kick back and read some novels for a change? He says, you can tell them that what I do is I watch the breath. That's what I'm doing. It is a good meditation before, during, and after enlightenment. So even a Buddha needs to withdraw, finds it profitable to withdraw. Even fully enlightened, the arahants, what do they do after awakening? They prefer to remain in meditation. They prefer to spend their time, if they have the situation allows it, it's appropriate. They tend to spend their time in the pleasant abiding of jhana. This is where some of them might practice jhana based on loving kindness still. Doesn't mean that the arahant is finished with loving kindness or compassion. Or they might just do it on a non-discursive subject, or even stay in the deep, the higher jhanas, the arupa formless jhanas. Even to the arahant, they're not suffering anymore. So one would ask, you know, why would they feel a need to do that? Well, you got to ask yourself the question. You got to be somewhere. Even if you're an arahant, you can't. You still have to do. You have to be somewhere consciously. So the only other choice is to be unconscious. So as long as you still have a body and mind, you have to do something with it. You have to put it somewhere. And you basically have two choices. The world. What is the world? World is the eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, body, and thinking consciousness. So you've got to put your mind somewhere. And even the fully enlightened, the arahant, feels the contact with the sensory world is wearisome. It takes energy up. It requires a certain kind of extra energy just to be conscious of the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and also the thinking process. Not necessarily the mind itself. Awareness of the mind is not necessarily draining, but it is even well-directed thoughts, you know, around a specific subject. It has its place, and it can be joyful, but after a while that may grow wearisome. I might find that wearisome. Then I would prefer to let that go. I wouldn't want to do that all the time. I would think now, let me let go of this energy and go to a more refined or restful condition, more peaceful condition. That is letting go of thoughts. So generally speaking, the preferred spectrum where one would prefer to stay is in from the first jhana on. The rest of the activities for a fully enlightened person are to do with just the ordinary matter of getting food. Like the arahant still has to go alms round. They still might have to travel around. They have responsibilities in terms of the community. Unless they're a hermit living in a cave, which is also a possibility, they would have to, you know, have some. They would have to attend to the nature of the buildings, arranging the community. So they would have still. They're bound by vinaya, or the rules of discipline, to participate in a competent and thorough way in ordinary aspects of the monastic life. They still have to make, you know, have duties towards the eating bowl, the robes, their dwelling, other members of the community. They still have to show up at least twice a month for confession. Even though they have nothing to confess, they still have to make themselves present. There's no exemption for that. So you're in an area of responsibility and response to other members of the community, if there are other monks around. Like, for instance, if you're a hermit, again, you don't have to confess to another monk if there's no other monk around. But you recall it, and you have a duty to declare for yourself that it is the day of the confession. And the other aspect that the arahant, a fully enlightened person, would take up out of compassion is teaching. So they would be responsive to both, you know, requests by lay people to teach and also monks. And they might have monks dependent on them in terms of their training, and they might have lay people who need and want various advice and so forth. So those are the obligations. They don't do that for fun. They don't need it for fulfillment. They don't feel like it's not like their lives would be empty if they didn't teach. You know, it is simply a spillover of compassion. Compassion remains. So, again, for the. So, you know, to some degree we should consider that, emulate that. And remember that, so, you know, when you learn the skills of meditation, suddenly it doesn't take away all of the energy draining aspect of the world. Simply to have your eyes open takes energy. You know, to see anything takes energy. You know, that's why it's nice to some people just want to. It's nice, the sky's blue, the sun's shining, see some birds, very nice, it's refreshing for a while, and then, it'd be nice to go inside and just sit down and just close my eyes for a while. Yeah, this is also, one should pay attention to this and try to be sensitive enough. Quite often we get so rushed around in the world that we're not paying attention to our own needs, or it never occurs to us. But if the idea occurs to us, it'd be nice to just shut down for a while. It doesn't have to be lie down on your bed and pull the covers over your head. That's sometimes, if a person has no exposure to meditation, sometimes that's the only thing they know how to do. It's either you're in a kind of a sort of hotbed of melodrama and verbal fighting, or you've crawled into bed and covered your head, don't want to come out. There's nothing in between. So we shouldn't realize that there are all kinds of things in between, and be responsive to it, respect the nature, what's calling to you inside, saying, this is a bit wearisome. So that's not a defeat, to acknowledge that one is a bit weary of it. That's you should inquire intelligently into that, say, how should I address this? Let me find an opportunity for refreshment of myself. And to clearly know, realize that turning away, shutting down the senses is not turning or running away from the world. What you are doing is intelligently moving towards refreshment and peace. You know, why would you choose to remain in a condition that your inner voice is telling you is that is wearisome to you? Only if you have, of course, you have to do the appropriate thing. You still have obligations in the world, and this is, the Buddha acknowledges this. He says the householder's life is a busy life. You got to do what you have to do. There's duties to be taken care of. You got to make a livelihood. There's kids, and there's parents, and there's friends, and all of this tangle. You can't just walk around negligently saying that I'm spiritual. I don't need to do anything. He says, no, that's not the way to do it. It'll just turn out to be a worse mess if you do that. So you just have to make some sensible judgments about what you're willing to do and what you can legitimately give to yourself as your personal time for development. And you have to some degree, you can't just buy into everybody's value systems and assume that just because they're resistant, well, I can't very well just meditate. You know, if they don't all approve of what I do and all agree and think that's a wonderful thing, well, you know, you can't please everybody all the time. And just they'll have to accept it, and you'll have to accept it, that your values are slightly different, and they're completely legitimate, and in fact, you can be, you should develop confidence after a while, but the value of meditation is a superior value, and that people who are resistant to that and everything simply don't understand, and that it is unprofitable for them to have that kind of attitude towards it. And so you understand that they don't understand, but nevertheless that you don't have to comply always with that value structure just to fit in. Sometimes you have to go against the stream even of your own resistance. So you know it's good to lay down a schedule for yourself and to practice even when you don't feel like it. It's not always profitable just to practice when you feel like it. Ajahn Chah, you know, it's one of the very great teachings. You know, if you just follow your desires all the time, you won't. There are certain things you won't develop. So, you do have to go against the stream sometimes and practice when you don't want to. We were talking the other day about the polarity. If you're inclining to sluggishness and drowsiness, and you feel like, well, I should go to bed and not practice, then of course that's not the remedy. Neither is serenity meditation at that point. The remedy is some sort of energetic inquiry or motion of the mind in either catering to sluggishness and sleepiness, nor are you unwisely taking up the subject of serenity at the wrong time. And also when you're feeling a little on the agitated side and everything, you don't feel like sitting down and everything, that's not the time to just flick on the TV or go play badminton or something and forget about your meditation. That is the time to cultivate serenity, even against the stream of your natural tendency towards agitation. It's not the time to cultivate energy. It's the time to cultivate serenity. So you would, in both those cases, you might not feel like it, but that's the time to do it. That's the reminder, say, oh, wait a second, I don't feel like it. That is the time not to just go along with wherever the mind leads me. That is the time to try and divert this energy. You might even have two periods a day for your meditation. One, the morning, which is always a good time as far as the chances of likelihood of being interrupted. There's very few calls for an invitation to dinner at 5 in the morning. Most people are mercifully not up. There's another trick you can use, you know, if you get up really extraordinarily, insanely early, and you go to bed really extraordinarily early, you miss a lot of the hubbub and useless squandering of energy of life. Most people are, you know, there's a couple of good hours there in the morning that nothing, no one else is up yet, and it's a good time to be. And then there's a couple of hours in the evening where people are fiddling around trying to fill the time and so forth with useless activities. And if you're asleep, that's, you get out of it. You know, you go to bed. So it's good to get up really early, and then, you know, you don't have to drag yourself around till late at night. Just go to bed early. You know? Get you out of a few hours of trouble on both sides of the day, and provide some useful time. But you might even schedule yourself one period is when sort of an optimal period, a good time for you, the morning period, and then there's a period of time when it's not particularly a good time for you. You have to struggle against it, and you schedule in a little meditation when it's not a good time for you. And that's the time when you do your meditation when you don't feel like it. That's when you do your don't feel like it meditation. You fully expect not to feel like it, and that's when you schedule it. That's your schedule. And then, of course, I mean, you don't do this all the time. You have your time, your feel like it meditation time. I feel like it this time. I rejoice in it. Oh, great! My salvation. My meditation time. That's good. And then then that, but don't just leave it at that, because you'll condition yourself to only do it when you feel like it. I also have another little conditioning that you build in. A little time when you don't feel like it. Characteristically, don't feel like it, but you do have the time. I mean, that's the thing, is you do have the time, but you generally don't feel like it. Do it then, but don't have unrealistic don't bring more suffering on yourself if it's a time when you're kind of dragging things back from work and it's still playing on your mind. Well, that's fine. That's whatever is perfect. You've got to sit down with that attitude that it may not be the time that you're going to have a lot of serenity, but it is a time when you can still get a lot of benefit from asking the mind to come back again and again, no matter how many times it goes away, to come back again and again. This is profitable. It's the frustration of thinking that every time I sit down it should be perfect. You know, that's a frustration. Sit down with the full expectation, this is not going to be easy. This is going to be difficult. My natural tendency is to be doing something else at this time, so I fully expect that. Then there's not all the frustration and difficulty with it. Half of the problem's gone. So Ajahn Chah would sometimes do this. You know, he'd ask everybody after the main meal in the hot season, the one meal a day, being up since 3 a.m, to come back after you wash the bowl and sit with your robes on, fully wrapped up in these robes. It's very hot. It could be 100 degrees in Sala. You've just had your one heavy meal of the day, and you really would be like, what you really want to be is outside in a cool place with a breeze on your face, walking up and down so you can just stay awake or stay up. And then, Now, normally speaking, he would encourage you to do that, but every now and then he would say, just come back and sit. And you'd be in this sweltering, hot place with a huge stomach full of food and wrapped up in your robes, the last place that you naturally want to go. But, that's also a time to sometimes go against it. Find out that you don't have to make such a problem out of it. The conditions always don't have to be perfect. It's all right to be there. You know you've got a belly full of food. You know you're too hot. You know you should be out walking. You completely acknowledge that, and you don't think, I wish I was anywhere else. As long as you're not separating from yourself, making comparisons about other realities, then it's not a problem. This is this is maybe more important than discovering the bliss of samadhi, is how not to separate from the situation, how to be with the situation without whining. This is Ajahn Chah's special recipe for whining monks. Make them do things they don't like to do, and then watch their whining mind. As a favorite word in the English monasteries, Ajahn Sumedho, he's picked up this English word, whinging, to whinge. I remember I did a retreat with Ajahn Biradamal. He's a Canadian monk, but he spent some time as the abbot at Amaravati. And this is a regular part of the discourse to the monastic community about this whinging, you know. You watch the whining, whinging mind. And I had heard him say this word before, and I knew right away that the Canadian audience is not 90% whinging. What the heck's that? You know. So I had already come up ahead of time with a definition for that. And somebody asked from the audience, Ajahn, you got whinging all the time. What is whinging? So whinging is, you combine the two words wincing and whining. And you put those two together, you come up with whinging. So when you wince, come back and whine at the same time, I don't want to do it. I don't want to be here. How come I have to do this? That put together is whinging. And this is a watch your mind with that. You'll be involved in that. if you're part of the organizing a retreat, have responsibilities in the retreat, even if you have a little responsibility, like you have to ring the bell, sometimes you think, how am I have to do this? I came here on retreat. I should not have to. I have a busy life all the time. Now they give me a bell to ring. I have to watch. I want to be. That, of course, is whinging. That is how you make yourself suffer. That's never the end of... You will never come to the end of suffering if you do that. So I might say about 50% of the Dhamma... You would expect in monasteries where monks are living there their whole lives, you know, and the abbots maybe 50 years in the robes, and there's lots of, you know, people 10, 20 years there. What do you think about what the Dhamma talk would be? You know, about Abhidhamma, there are, you know, 17 thought moments in a, you know, in a series, and the middle third, or, you know, that determine whether the karma arises immediately, or, you know, you'd think it would be that kind of thing, you know. Or just the refinements of Arupa Jhana, the eighth Arupa Jhana, just whether or not you're quite in it, you know. No, it's more about whinging, you know. And whether, you know, you talk when you wash the bowls outside there, you know. I want to remind you one more time, you know, not to get into frivolous conversations while you watch the bowl. Or the whinging mind. That is the whining mind, you know. Why do I have to sweep the leaves? I didn't come here to sweep leaves. I came here to be a monk. Why are we always sweeping leaves? I mean, we're obsessed with sweeping leaves. So it's as if the path, you know, why don't we just let them fall, like in nature, or are we supposed to be natural, right? And it's like, oh, blah, 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 blah. Ajahn Sumedho has a beautiful story about that. That's exactly what he was. You know, he was he was one of the first disciples of Ajahn Chah in the late 60s, or back in about 67. He managed to just get out of... He had done graduate school in anthropology at Berkeley, he finished in about 1964, just before everything hit. There was the beatnik movement going on, of course. He was a beatnik. He was before the hippies. And he got out just in time, but he was still very influenced by the the individualistic kind of attitude to things, and everybody was eccentric, and that you're kind of proud of your eccentricities, and how everything should be. And he went off to be a monk, and, you know, to live in solitude. And he found himself in a monastery where it was highly disciplined, highly, highly structured. And one of the things you had to do was, like, sweep the paths all the time. And when I was there too, it was sweeping the paths. And some of the abbots would make it even... It's somewhat pointless. It was extraordinarily clean and everything, but you wonder why you have to always be sweeping paths. It's hot out there, and, you know. Even one of the monasteries I was at, the abbot would have us... You had to do it in this peculiar way. There were ditches on the side of the road. The idea would be to sweep, you know, the sensible idea would sweep the leaves off to the side, right? Sweep the leaves off to the side. You can just do it in a jiffy. In a few 10 minutes, you'd be finished. Well, no, he's got a special way. You sweep the leaves into the middle of the road. Then you go and you pick them up, and then you carry them over to the side. You have to do this. Now, why you have to do this, you can never figure out. He says it's because of you don't erode the road. So eventually you'll sweep the road will go up into the ditch. So you sweep towards the center, then you pick the leaves up, and then you walk over. This takes you five times as long. And it's dusty, and it's problematic, and stuff. No, you just have to do it. The abbot says so. Ajahn Sumedho was doing that, you know, the sweeping thing, and just thinking, oh, why? There's all kinds of ways of doing this. Why don't we get somebody else to do that, or something? You know? And Ajahn Chah was walking by, and he really, you know, you were asking about thought transfers. He just walked right up to him. He said, Sumedho, suffering in the broom, and he just walked away. Is the suffering in the broom? Ajahn Sumedho just taken out of his whining, you know, it's just like he'd been, and he'd go get the worst. You have to go to a special place to get a new broom and everything, and he'd get some old junker of a broom that was sort of half broken, and he'd work, and it wouldn't work properly, you know, so it'd take him twice as long to do it, but he just didn't want to be bothered to go get the proper thing and trim it, and so all kinds of frustrations and whining in his way. And then it just startled him. Is the suffering in the broom? Is the suffering in the broom? Is the suffering in the broom? No, the suffering's, I'm the one that's suffering. Yeah, I guess that's the point, isn't it? You know, the broom's not suffering, you're suffering. Why don't you just sweep? Quit whining. You don't have to suffer, just sweep. So he learned, he understood. And then he was a very good sweeper after that. Extremely good sweeper, he just swept. So understand, this is one of the, you know, main points is how much suffering do you create for yourself by having a problem with every situation? It should be quieter. There should be more stimulation. You know, it's too quiet. There should be more entertainment. There's too much entertainment here. It's got to be quiet. Shouldn't be this. Should be that. So that is in the area of wisdom as well, as is disturbing one's mind with the critical. This is back to unwise reflection or unwise attention to a fault. We think we're very clever. We're able to perceive things. Perceive the fault and everything. We're taught this critical thinking capacity from childhood on. You're always asked to solve problems in school. Here's a problem. What's the answer to it? Here's a problem. What's the answer? Here's a problem. Here's a problem. You get an A for problem solving. You're rewarded. Oh, your parents say, "Oh, you're so good." You get it. You really everything's a problem. If your handwriting is not good, it's a problem. You don't get in printing, you don't get an A, and so forth. So you get into this mode where you get rewarded for solving problems and finding problems to solve. Write an essay on such and such. And you've got to have a critical voice. So you learn that the intelligent person is the person who finds a lot of problems and then searches for solutions and so forth, talks about the problems a lot, so makes problems, has problems with things. So we just become habitually looking for faults in systems, and it could be better this way, it could be that. We just end up disturbing ourselves a heck of a lot. So a lot of the suffering is just generated out of that thoughtless addiction. And we don't have to be that way. We can be more content. It's also good to reflect on our critical nature, you know, how nothing's ever good enough, and we can find problems and faults in anything. On the other hand, of course, there's the other side of the coin is like, is there anything constructive we can do about situations? That's where, that's the real admirable skill, isn't it? Actually be able to do something, go ahead and do it. There's a saying by, I think it's one of the U.S. senators. Somewhere I came across it. He was giving a speech in Congress about attitudes. He just said, "It must be a saying from Missouri or Mississippi or someplace like that." He said, "You know, a jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a carpenter to build one." So it stuck with me a long time because quite often you can pride yourself on being a bit of a jackass. You can kick down a structure. You can knock down a situation. You can see all the faults, all the problems in it. That's, you know, that's anybody who can kick can do that. You know. But can you put one together? A jackass can't build a barn. You know. Carpenter's a humble fellow. He just puts the boards together, but you have a barn at the end of it. You know. So we have to remind ourselves from time to time to, instead of just always focusing on how it could be better, what's wrong with this and so forth, we have to let go of that donkey mentality, the kicking mentality, and just start saying, I wonder what I could build. Maybe I could do something. I could build something. I can build a practice. I can construct a positive structure right with what I have. It's no good to imagine all of the ways it could be some other way. It's just starting right here, being very realistic, and making your practice right here in the humblest of situations. And once you do that, it's actually a very interesting experience. You start to wish, you don't wish for it to be any other way. You just start with the way it is. It's a beautiful, it releases you from a lot of division between how it could be and all the future, etc. Just like to read a few reminders for advice to lay people going out back into society and so forth, and association with people. Often, people, I'd have this this experience, well, in the present monastery, but also in Asia. Westerners would come through, and sometimes they'd spend 2-3 months in a monastery. And if you spend that long, often they come through in a searching way, trying to reorder the life, or just trying to feel better. And if they stay long enough, they do. They start to come back to life. And they start to really feel quite good. And the simplicity of the routine and the example of simplicity and having less speech and so forth revitalizes them. Their senses come back to life. They start to be able to appreciate just the smell of fresh air. They don't need a gourmet meal and a movie. It's enough to stand out in the sunlight for a little while. You come back to life. And then they start to think, this is what I came here for. I'm restored. I'm back to life. And one of the things is they realize, life isn't so bad. I just wasn't appreciative of a lot of things. I just wasn't appreciating it. Now I appreciate, to have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea is quite an event. It's quite a thing. You know, going to a monastery where you can't have it any time. Sometimes you just can't get it. And you have to do without. So you start to think, there were just little things that I should have paid more attention to and understood. I was just taking them for granted. You know, people, situations, a sunny day, just to, not to have pain in my body. And then they go on. I would warn them. Okay, that's nice to come back to life and everything. But you have to be careful, very very careful. How are you going to sustain this, especially out in the world? You have to be very careful with it. They would go and they would be determined to be careful because they appreciate it. They're glad of it. But then a year, 2 years, 3 years later, they be back, and so it's very nice to see somebody that, you know, you're off, way off in Asia, and you don't have to talk a lot with a person to get to, if you're in the same monastery for months, and you get to appreciate their life and who they are and their personalities, and then to see them years later, it's like, it's a wonderful sight to see a person, and you wonder how their life has been. So I would ask them, so how's it going, I'm back, I lost it, I lost it. And I'd say, how did you lose it? My relatives, that's how I lost it. That is the one thing, just my relatives is how I lost it. And so now I say, this is what you can't tell a person the first time. It's by association that you lose it. You have to be very careful about association. And then they would stay 2-3 months, the same thing, they come back to life, and they get to the same state. But this time when they went back, they know how you lose it. It's the primary way is by association. We're very moved by other beings' energies and the way they speak and do it. We are influenced by it. And we really have to be careful with how we associate, when we associate, who we associate with. That's how you lose it. advice to a layperson. This is from the Buddha's teaching. This is on the numbered sayings. He's speaking to a fellow named Tiger Paw. Nice name. Vyagapaja. Fellow's name. Tiger Paw. Now what, Tiger Paw, is meant by having admirable people as friends? There is the case where a layperson, in whatever town or village he may dwell, spends time with householders or householders' sons, young or old, who are advanced in virtue. He talks with them, engages them in discussions. He emulates consummate conviction in those who are consummate in conviction, consummate virtue in those who are consummate in virtue, consummate generosity in those who are consummate in generosity, and consummate discernment in those who are consummate discernment. This is called friendship with admirable people. We should reflect on that, how important it is to find people who you wish to emulate. And sometimes you can't find them, you know, next door, living next door to you. So you look, you know, look in books. I've been inspired by some books. I've personalities in time that I mean, really uplifted by, and that I've been able to read. Not many books I've ever read twice. There's very few books that I could ever imagine reading twice, but a few of them I have been able to, and just get refreshed from association with certain characters, uplifted by them. And so being careful and selective and looking for uplifting companionship in books and in people. And if you're, and in terms of media, being very selective, very careful about what you watch, what you listen to. Basic advice: choose your propaganda wisely. You're going to be propagated to out there. There's propaganda everywhere. Every bit of media is just full of propaganda. They're pushing some point or another. Since you got to be in it, deliberately realize that you're going to have to make propaganda for yourself as well. Choose the view that you want to be propagated to you, and then go about and do a skillful job and propagate it to yourself. Be very selective. Choose only certain books that lift up and coordinate with these qualities that you clearly want to develop. Choose, and in terms of association, deliberately seek out, spend some time and effort to seek out beings that you find uplifting. Look around, seek right association. I mean, you're already obviously done that. You're here. This is a very unusual thing. How many people in this whole city are ever going to go to take a week out of their lives and go to a quiet place, associate, you know, think again and again about generosity, virtue, restraint of the mind, how the mind works, the nature of suffering? Very rare. But so I congratulate you just for doing this, but just keep it up, especially out there. A friend endowed with these three qualities is worth associating with. Which three? He gives what is hard to give. He does what is hard to do. And he endures what is hard to endure. A friend endowed with these three qualities is worth associating with. So these are, and people do have these qualities. They do what is hard to do. One thing that's hard to do is to go to a meditation retreat and endure it sometimes. They do what, to arrange their situation, to support their family, support their friends. These things are hard to do. And to be generous, to share with other people when you only have limited resources as well. To share with your resources. And he endures what is hard to endure. The person is solid. In your own, while you have problems and difficulties, and you're not always such a great person to be with, live with, that person endures. They put up with it. And they are always endlessly forgiving. So these are great, you know, inspiring people to be with. You know, these qualities make people just stand out above the whole sea of humanity. They just stand up there. You think of all of the figures, the great figures, even of the 20th century, who have these three characteristics. They give what is hard to give. They do what is hard to do, and they endure what is hard to endure. Just think about Mother Teresa. She would have given what is hard to give. Didn't have any money, completely poverty, but all the time, gave all the time. Does what is hard to do. To live in the middle of Calcutta and in the sea of suffering humanity, and to go ahead and do something about it. Hard to do. And to endure what is hard to endure. So that's why everybody, you know, it's a huge admiration for that character. Or Gandhi, or there's all kinds of other people, and also the secret saints. You never hear of them, but they do what is hard to do. They endure what is hard to endure. They give what is hard to give. Find these people through media, through books, through ideas, through your memory, and through direct real association. These three things have been promulgated by wise people, by people who are truly good. Which three?